The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
On a fairly regular basis, there are people who come to me and ask me about my experience with practicing both the Zen Buddhism and the Vipassana or Theravadan Buddhism. And some people would like to have more of a philosophical contrasting of the two. They'd like to see what the differences are and similarities. And some people would like to know more personally for me what it's like for me and why I chose one over the other. Why did I switch? Why did I leave Zen and take Vipassana instead? And that's the assumption people have. And it happens a lot. And generally, I'm pretty shy to answer those kinds of questions, partly because they're not answerable in quick, simple terms. And also because in comparing Zen and Vipassana, there are different schools of Zen, different schools of Vipassana, and so you have to kind of differentiate which schools you're talking about. And you make general statements about Zen, chances are they're not going to be so accurate. There's Rinzai Zen and Soto Zen and different schools. And so what I'd like to do today is to answer this question by giving you partly my story around both of them, my biography, how I went through all this. And so it's kind of my practice story. And I do this with a little bit of reluctance for two reasons. One is that some people might be inclined to compare themselves to my particular path and how it's gone for me. And that would be unfortunate because everyone's going to have their own way. This just happened to be my peculiar way. And the other reluctance is that there is a shyness sometimes in Buddhist tradition of people talking about themselves too much. And I think there's some wisdom to that, especially maybe in our culture where building up the self can be such a big thing, individual. And so to focus on the self and one individual person, their experiences, maybe can give a wrong message about what the whole point of practice is. They're supposed to become somehow unique or special or something. But I hope that the benefits of giving this talk outweigh the problems. So, as many of you know, I started off in the Zen tradition. And before Zen even, I first became interested in Buddhism when I was 19. And the initial interest was relatively intellectual. Though I think heartfelt enough. It was, I was a college student and I was potentially draftable into the Vietnam War, and I was a pacifist, and in my pacifist beliefs I felt that pacifism wasn't being passive. I felt like I had to be able to be willing to put myself actively, acts of civil disobedience, the Vietnam War was going on, and the opportunity, as college students were getting killed in America in their protest to the war, and I thought that maybe to live by my beliefs, I would have to someday put myself on the line, my life on the line. And I recognized that I was afraid of dying, and I didn't know if I could follow through on my nonviolent activist beliefs. So I cast about for something that would help me with dealing with that kind of fear of death. And some for a reason that I don't know, I kind of thought, oh, Buddhism has something to say about that. And the other reason, the attraction to Buddhism, was I was a born-again environmentalist in college. And the books Limits to Growth had just come out, and so the oil spill in Santa Barbara had just happened. I went to school in Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, big oil spill down there. The year before I got there, the students burned the Bank of America. So it was kind of an active time. So I was kind of born again environmentalist. And as we studied these things in college, one thing led to, from environmental studies, when I came to political studies, thinking I have to fix the politics. And from political studies, we came to studying what we called consciousness, kind of the basic kind of worldview that people live by. That something very deep in people's psyche had to change, not just politics. And that led to being interested in Eastern thought, which was kind of, you know, popular in those circles at that time. And with that came the interest in Buddhism. So that was my initial interest. And when I was 19, I didn't start practicing regularly until I was about 21. By that time, I'd been introduced to meditation, and I'd read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki Roshi. And when I read that book, it kind of spoke to me. It was like a book that's, you know, speaking my own thoughts kind of thing. And it was really it was very important for me. And the first chance I had, I went to San Francisco Zen Center and was introduced to the practice there, which was also very meaningful for me. And I thought, this is what something I want to do with my life, what I want to do. But I dropped out of college and a few other things, and I had a number of loose threads in my life at the age of 20, 21. And I thought I had to kind of tie up those loose ends. And so it's been 3 years tying up those loose ends. And after the first of those 3 years, I went back to college, to finish college. And then I started practicing every day, my Zen meditation. I did it twice a day, 40 minutes each day, except for Sunday, because the San Francisco Zen Center, they don't sit Zazen on Sunday. So I thought, that makes sense, day off. And so twice a day. And what prompted me to start my regular practice like that was that I was suffering. It was rather intellectual things about, you know, pacifism or environment and all that. It was just, you know, that I was socially awkward. I had my own anxiety, and guilt, and various variety of things, and I felt like I needed to address this. And so I finished my college at UC Davis with a very strong regular sitting practice twice a day. There was a sitting group that I went to twice a week, small sitting group. And one of the remarkable things that happened to me during the first few months of sitting Zazen regularly is that the reasons for sitting meditating disappeared. They fell away. All this, you know, dealing with my suffering, my neurosis and all that. It wasn't like my suffering went away exactly, or neurosis went away, but somehow it wasn't motivating in the same way. It wasn't motivated, this is why I'm sitting, or to fix this, all this stuff. And I thought it was really strange that I was meditating. I continued twice a day without a reason. And I'm kind of a rational kind of guy, so, you know, this is strange. You know, I should have a reason, but I kept sitting. Just sitting and sitting. Why am I doing this? And at some point, after some months of, I came to the understanding that I was meditating because it was a form of self-expression. Just as the way an artist would paint or sculpt or, you know, to express herself or himself. So the Zazen for me was a form of expression that had expressed something very deep within me. And so the point of, for me, of the Zen meditation was not to get anything or attain anything, you know, in a particular way, but more in a sense of just to be present and let something be present, be flow, just be there. Certain kind, and I call it, at that time I called it, there was a sense of integrity with my meditation practice. It was a place where I felt most integrity, most authentic in a way. It settled, relaxed, and all that. And this was very meaningful for me for its own sake. And at some point in those 2 years of college, continuing this way, I began feeling that it was rather arbitrary, the line between sitting and meditation in daily life. And I wanted to take that authenticity or that integrity and live it in my life as well. And then it became my quest for a long time not to go deeper in meditation, but rather to, in a sense, let the meditation, the way of being in meditation, spill out into my daily life. And around this time, I was also visiting San Francisco Zen Center communities and one-day sittings and periodically. And I noticed that when I hung out there, that it was very helpful for me, because I still had these social games that I was playing, you know, that trying to present myself in certain ways, trying to be seen in certain ways, trying to impress people. And when I tried to play those games at the Zen Center with some of the more senior practitioners there, I felt they were mirrors for me. It was, it bounced right back at me. Basically, they didn't play the game. And it was kind of painful to have the mirroring, but I really valued it. This is really good. I wanted to get that help. So then when I finished college, I was really motivated to move to the Zen Center and get the support from that community in this quest I had to try to bring it into the rest of my life. And so I went to live there in 1978. And then first I lived right next door to Zen Center, nearby. Worked at the Tassajara Bakery. And then I went to Green Gulch Farm for a while. So then I was in residence, and from there I went to Tassajara, the Zen Monastery. And each of those steps, it was really a desire to try to make this experience of Zazen, this sense of integrity, a fuller part of my life, so that I was living it completely as much as I could. So it wasn't so much a desire to go deeper into meditation as it was whatever was happening in meditation, which wasn't that deep from what I, you know, what can happen. It was enough for me. It was just felt going deep wasn't the point. The point was this integrity. And part of the sense of integrity, I think, for me was an understanding that Zen practice was about an unconditional acceptance of what was, what's happening in this present moment. So whatever was going on, it wasn't a matter of fixing it or getting better or improving myself or attaining something, but it was to have that full meeting, just to meet this experience without resistance, without desire and grasping, without trying to push it away, without getting caught up in my thoughts about it or whatever, but just to be able to have this full meeting, this presence here, just now. So that was my sense of practice, and it turned out that this Soto Zen teaching that I got was very akin to that. And partly there was a mutuality. I was learning from those teachings and had my own experience of that. And so it was very valuable for me to kind of just sit there, and I didn't know anything about concentration or mindfulness and all the different things that can happen in meditation. And I was really fortunate, because if I'd known all the things that could happen in meditation, I would have been measuring myself and trying and huffing and puffing, and I probably would have given up and done something else with my life. I didn't know any of that, and so I just was naive enough just to sit with what was, not trying to make a difference, just be present for what was there. And, you know, I had many, many months, years of sitting there with Zen practice, meditating, and a lot of it was painful. Some of it was quite wonderful, the whole range of things. But in some ways, the difficult parts of the meditation practice were the most beneficial for me. Because when I was sitting with physical pain or emotional pain or whatever, and just being present for it, learning how to be present for it, without any idea it should be any different, there was a kind of a purification, a cleansing, an emptying process, a deepening, a sense, a deeper and deeper connection to feeling of just... just being alive is enough. Just being, a beingness, and rather than trying to attain something, get something, just to be. And you know, much of that experience was not so pleasant for me. I had my neurosis. I had my different difficulties. And slowly in that fire, one of the things that seemed to have happened is that the crusts of my heart started to loosen up a little bit. And lo and behold, unsolicited, undesired by me, was that I started to develop greater sense of compassion. I got compassion by that practice. So then when I, at some point, I thought I had to decide what to do with my life. I had been accepted to a graduate program at UC Berkeley. And I was living at the Zen Monastery, and actually I was accepted in 1980 to go to UC Berkeley. And just a week or two before classes started, I wrote a letter to the department there and said, something important has come up, and I can't start this year. And so I didn't tell them the important thing was I was going to a monastery. But they said, okay, you can start next year. So I had this hanging over me. And for the year, the monastery. So I spent a lot of time wondering what to do with my life and should I go back to school, what should I do? And at some point I decided that what I wanted to do was to be ordained as a Zen monk. Because by that time, I felt like what I wanted to do, or what I should do, or what I could, what I was going to do, was I was going to try to respond to the suffering of the world. And going back to graduate school was also that motivation. But I wanted to try to. I felt like I'd be not satisfied if I was responding to the suffering of the world any place else but at the root, the heart of suffering, where it begins. And from my understanding at that time, I had this feeling that the core suffering was a clinging to self. And the only place I knew in the world, my limited experience of the world, was Buddhism really addresses this issue of the core issue of clinging to self. So I thought, well, I'm going to engage myself full-time in Buddhism, become a monk, and try to support other people to practice so they can try to touch this very central area of suffering. And I had no idea that I was going to be a teacher exactly. There were 50 priests at San Francisco Zen Center who were ahead of me in line. And there was this whole procedure which you had to go through in order to become a teacher. And one of the first things you had to do, kind of important steps, was you had to be the head monk during a 3-month practice period. And there's going to be one head monk a year. And there are only 2 practice periods a year. Only one head monk a practice period, and only 2 practice periods a year. So I calculated. It would take me 25 years before, you know, I even got even close to being kind of on the edge of being a teacher. I thought, okay, that's fine with me. It wasn't that wasn't the point. And so one of the things that this that's often overlooked when people think about Zen is that one of the central aspects of Zen practice is the bodhisattva vows, the commitment or the vow, the commitment to live one's life for the welfare and liberation of others as well. So it's a response to others. So even though Zen sometimes in the popular mind might be about just being fully concentrated, really present for things as they are, in fact, the religious side of Zen Buddhism is held, right? The context for it is this experience of the compassion engagement to the world. So I was very happy with my Zen practice. I loved being in the Zen monastery. I thought that the Zen life, Zen monastic life at Tassajara was the perfect lifestyle. Maybe I'm weird. But I was very happy there. And even though it was hard. And then at some point I came back to San Francisco, lived in the city center. And then San Francisco Zen Center had its scandal, Abbott's scandal. It seemed like in the 1980s it was kind of required for Buddhist groups in America to have a scandal with their teachers. And so San Francisco had theirs. And that's a long story, but the short story for me here is that that freed me in a certain way from the abbot of Zen Center. And my response to that freedom was I went to Japan. And partly the reason I went to Japan was my father was going to be in Japan that year. And he said, "Why don't you come?" And so so I went to Japan and went to practice Zen in Japan. And with no other thoughts about any other kind of Buddhism. And then it turned out that I knew in getting my ticket to go to Japan from San Francisco that I needed to, after 3 months of being in Japan, I'd have to go out of Japan to get a new visa to come back in, stay longer. So I thought, well, what's the cheapest way to do that was to get actually a round-trip ticket from San Francisco to Bangkok with a stop each direction at in Japan. It was like only $25 more or something, $50 more. So that's what I did. So I had a ticket to Bangkok. And then I had a friend here in this country who had a very good friend who was a monk in a little monastery outside of Bangkok. And I was a Zen priest. And I had this idea that in Theravadan countries they had a living tradition of Buddhist psychology, which I'd studied a little bit. And I was kind of a priest, and I knew other people having experience in meditation I never had. And I thought, well, I don't have to have those, but I should at least know the map of meditation so I can talk to them about their experiences. So this idea of the map of Buddhist psychology. So I went. So when I got there to get my visa, I applied at the embassy in Bangkok. And then I went to this little dog patch kind of monastery. It was kind of a mess, pigs running around. And it was kind of a small little place. But this American monk was there, a friend of a friend. And I showed up and said, I'm here, and just I'm here until my visa comes, and just tell me what to do. So they gave me a little kuti, a little hut in the edge of the monastery over the swamps, where they had this big kind of, I don't know what it was, like a lizard alligator or something, and walking around, and this pig, and the wild dogs. And that, right next to my little cabin was a grave site. So I walked in my walking meditation on top of the grave. And it took me 10 weeks to realize that my visa was not going to come. And so my first experience of Vipassana was a 10-week retreat. That's what we should do for Dharma talks. There should be sound effects that kind of... canned laughter and that would really help the talks, I'm sure. So those 10 weeks was the longest that I ever sat a retreat. In Zen tradition, you have these 3-month retreats. However, you work during the retreat, you study a variety of things, and you have at the end of the retreat, you have a 7-day intensive retreat. And this was a 10-week intensive retreat. Basically, all I did day and night was my meditation, sitting and walking. And in those 10 weeks, I touched something inside of me, a level of stillness, of silence that I'd never known before. And I touched something deep inside of me, which at the time I called a sense of self, a little seed, a very little seed. And I had no sense that sense of self was a bad thing, but it was this little seed that's kind of at the core of my stillness. And it became essential for me to touch that place again. And I can't tell you exactly why, but it became kind of like a biological imperative. It became kind of like a dark night of the soul for me, that I just knew that I had to come back and get to that place again. And I went. I did go back to Japan, and the Zen experience this time was a little bit disillusioning for me for a variety of reasons. But one reason was that there wasn't a lot of meditation in the monastery I was in. And I really had the need, this inner kind of drive, to deep meditation and touch this place again. And since the only place I knew how to do it was in these Vipassana retreats, then the desire was to go back to Vipassana. At the end of my year, I went back to San Francisco at the Zen Center. And Zen Center was very supportive of me at this point. They gave me free room and board while I worked at Green's restaurant to earn the money to go right back to Asia. After about 4 months, I went back and with about $2,000 in my mind for the duration. You know, I had nothing else. Nothing else had any meaning for me. Nothing else was going on for me. But I just knew I had to go back. I was going to go and be there for however long it took. Without any clear idea what it meant. It was like the end of the road. I come to the end of the road, this is what I was going to do. And it took me a little while to finally get to Burma, where I wanted to go at this point, because the Vipassana meditation had been taught. In a sense, its origin was a particular monastery in Burma, the Mahasi Center, so I wanted to go there. And eventually was able to get there. And there I sat for 8 months. And 8 months, like 8 months of Shin. 8 months, that's all I did was sit and walk. And didn't talk to anyone except the teachers, basically for 8 months, once a day or so. And it was a really beautiful time. People think that's a strange thing to do, you know, sit in silence. I had mostly sat in my own room, you know, no contact with other people really. And really, really happy. Lots and lots of joy. It's a beautiful time. And but it wasn't that I'd chosen Vipassana over Zen. It was that it was the Vipassana retreat mode that was the only place I knew where I could touch this thing again. I'd stumbled onto Vipassana in Thailand. Something very personally important happened. I had to do it again. I had to follow through. And the place I knew to do it was through this Vipassana. And in my mind, I was going to continue sitting Zazen. That's what I was doing. My meditation practice was basically to sit and be fully present for what is, without any idea that it had to be any different, without trying to attain anything particularly. Just as full contact with reality. But what I learned in doing it in the Vipassana world, from the teacher there, was the tremendous subtlety and precision by which that can be done. It's one thing to say I'm going to be fully present for today. You know, today is a big day. So yes, I can be present for today. It's another thing to say I'm going to be present for the beginning of the next thought. Be really, the very beginning of it. That's much more subtle than saying be present for today. So what I learned with great subtlety and precision, the minuteness by which my mind would be non-accepting, my mind would react, pull away, think, get lost, do all the different things. And so the Vipassana practice showed me how to be attentive and careful so I can watch all those little movements of the mind, this more and more subtle movement of the mind, so that I could be more thorough in this attempt to be really present for things. So I was doing it, and at some point my teacher there, Pandita, told me in a kind of in a good Theravadan way, he said, "Okay, Gil, when you sit down, make a resolution to strive for nirvana." And so I said, "Okay." And then I came back the next day and said, "I can't do that." And he said, "What?" He said, that's not what I'm here to do. I'm not here to attain nirvana. And he looked at me kind of like, "What in the world? Isn't that the whole point?" I said, "No, I'm here to be really present for things." And he said, "Oh, that's what we're trying to do here. That's good." Okay, so then I thought we had an understanding. And then the next day, I came back and he said, "Gil, strive for nirvana." So I said, "Okay, well," I just ignored him then. But I was, but 8 months is a long time, and what happens in that kind of careful mindfulness that I was doing, it does, what I consider a natural process that can unfold, a natural process of deepening, a path that opens up for a person. And I didn't know what this path was, but there's a path called the progress of insight. And so I was introduced to this path by going through it. I didn't know what it was. And then later, after I went through it, then I read a book about it. I said, "Oh, look at that. This is what happened to me. Isn't it amazing?" It became very, very, very meaningful for me. The Vipassana practice, how I was introduced to it, the teachings of it by that time. But more important, what happened to me as I went through it. And I would say that one of the most pivotal experiences of my life happened on that retreat and kind of shifted everything for me. It was like a revolution in my mind and my heart. So when that kind of big shift, had to make a big impression on me. And one of the interesting things that happened during my time in Burma, those 8 months, after about 2 months of sitting there in silence, deep practice, very concentrated, I would have these little thoughts creep into my head of the San Francisco Zen Center. The people there, I'd have conversations with them, thoughts about advancement within Zen Center, positions within Zen Center, and all these things that you're not really a heart of Buddhism. And I thought, this is weird to have this, the Zen Center is so embedded in my, so deeply in my psyche. And I made a vow not to go back to Zen Center until I had Zen Center out of my mind. And so after some time, I went back to San Francisco with no thoughts of going back to Zen Center. But I had a girlfriend who wanted to live at Green Gulch. So I went back to Green Gulch and lived there but worked in San Francisco for a little while. And I was intent to go and do more Vipassana practice. But then it didn't seem right. It seemed like I was, after 8 months, this 8 month intensive period, I was weary, somehow psychically weary from that. So I said, I'm going to wait a while before I go to IMS, the retreat center in Massachusetts. And since I was living at Zen Center at Green Gulch without anything to do, as soon as the people there learned that, they came to me and asked me, well, will you take this position, the Eno, you take be the head of the meditation hall? And I said, sure. Why not? And it was great. I loved it. I had a wonderful year at Green Gulch, being head of the meditation hall and running the practice periods and things. And then I went back to IMS. And before I went back to IMS, I did go see Jack Kornfield. Soon after I came back from America, from Burma, I was so enthusiastic, you know. I was kind of like in a retreat mode, kind of a little altered state of somehow. A little bit too zealous. And by something that was so meaningful for me, of course, you get pretty excited. And I hardly knew Jack Kornfield. Maybe we never even met. I talked to him on the phone once. But I called him up and said, can I meet with you? And I want to talk to you about my experiences in Burma. And he was kind enough to see me. And then I said to him, will you train me to be a teacher in this stuff? And he said to me, oh, in 20 years you'll be a good teacher. And later I thought about what he'd said. I said, oh, he just kind of politely kind of brushed the kid off. You know, I mean, it's kind of presumptuous, you know, to go to someone you don't even know and say, well, you make me a teacher. But it wasn't presumptuous. I was just so naive. So he said, you know, basically said no. And then I went to IMS for 3 months. Had a wonderful time there, very meaningful time there, 3 month retreat. And then I came back and to be the Shuso. Remember that thing you had to wait for 25 years to do? Well, because of the Abbott scandal, a lot of those priests left. And so in 1988, January of 88, it became my turn. And it was a wonderful thing to do, to go from the 3 month retreat at IMS directly to the Zen retreat as well. So I did that position. And then I was very happy with Zen practice. You know, I was just doing my practices. I was very happy with both. It wasn't like I was choosing one over the other. I felt both Vipassana and both Zen were very profound. Both traditions, both practices by this time that I greatly loved. And I felt they also complemented each other very well. By this time I felt that one of the strengths of Vipassana is that it was so inclusive. I'd learned how to bring presence and mindfulness to the full range of my experience. Whereas in Zen, I'd learned how to be present very well in a certain kind of way, but I didn't really learn the skills of how to be present wisely for emotions, like my anger, for example, and different things. And in Vipassana, there's a lot of the instructions about how to be mindful for emotions, mindfulness of thoughts, mindfulness of all the different things, everything. And so I found it very helpful to have the practice expanded out that way, in a way that I hadn't had it in my Zen training. And however, the Zen training is much more than meditation practice. And so the monastic life, the working with other people in the monastery, and the friction that creates, and the different rituals, and the bowing, and the whole package of monastic training is so much more than meditation practice. And I found that very helpful for me as well. It gave me a lot, taught me a lot, showed me a lot, trained me in a variety of ways. So I got this very important training in Zen that is not really available in Vipassana. So then I, after being the Shuso, head monk for the practice period of Tassajara, it looked to me like I was being pushed into being a little more of a teacher. That was kind of the direction people seemed to be wanting me to go. And I didn't quite feel ready. In particular, I didn't feel ready because I'd spent, by this time, 10 years of my life in intensive meditation centers. I had spent maybe 2 weeks at a time, a year or something, outside of an intensive monastery. And I hadn't actually studied very much Buddhism. I practiced a lot. And I thought, well, before I become a teacher, I think I should learn more about this Buddhism stuff. And so I decided to go get a master's in religious studies specializing in Buddhism. And I decided to do it at the University of Hawaii, where, because I wanted to study with two people. I wanted to study with Robert Aitken Roshi, a Zen teacher, who does koan practice. And I wanted to study with a professor there named David Kalapahana, and a Buddhist professor from Sri Lanka. And so I went there for 2 years, and it was like a kid in a candy store for me to be introduced to all these Buddhist texts and sutras. And Master's program was so much fun. I just had a great blast. And practicing, doing Zen practice with Aiken Roshi was great. It was also great. And I liked him a lot. He was a wonderful, wonderful man, teacher. And near the end of that time in Hawaii, I got this phone call out of the blue, as far as I'm concerned, from Jack Kornfield. remember when I asked him if he would train me to teach? He said, you know, a little kid in 20 years, you know, something. But one of the things he did say, which I didn't quite click, was he said, maybe sometime. However, some American Vipassana teacher needs to know your practice first. So I didn't think about it anymore. But what happened was I went to IMS and studied with Joseph Goldstein. And after those 3 months with Joseph, Joseph told Jack, I think you should train this guy. And so then Jack called me up. And when he called me up and asked me, invited me to join his teacher training, it was kind of a unique experience where it was like you have a puzzle piece and you don't even know you have these pieces. You don't even exist, right? But as he asked me, I felt all the pieces I didn't even know I had line up. Like all these pieces in my life just come. And I said, of course. He said, okay, yes, I said. So then I started that training, and then I came back to San Francisco, partly to be near Zen Center again, because that was my practice community. So I wasn't choosing one over the other. I didn't have the feeling you had to choose one over the other. It's not like, you know, being, you know, Catholic, or, you know, choosing either to be a Catholic or a Protestant or a Catholic and a Muslim, or, you know, there's a little more sense of exclusion there with those kind of traditions. But, you know, it's, you know, Buddhism is Buddhism. So it's time is out. Should I continue a little bit longer? If you welcome, if some of you need to leave, you're welcome to go. I apologize for going late. So I came back and I ended up living at San Francisco Zen Center again. Oh, this time I thought the master's program in Buddhist study was so great. And I felt like I just kind of scratched the surface. And so I thought, well, I was encouraged to apply for a PhD program in Buddhist studies. And so I applied for two universities here in the Bay Area to do that. And I didn't expect to get accepted. And that was fine with me, because I had things to do. I was going to practice and study. But I got accepted. So I went to Stanford. And to my surprise, maybe some of you know this, but I didn't know it at the time, that a doctoral program is very different than a master's program. So I didn't know that. And it was a whole different kind of experience. But Stanford was very good because it was very easy there to... I would basically go to Stanford 2 quarters a year. And then the other 2 quarters I do other things. I go on retreat, I go teach retreat, you know, do different things. And so I didn't have to kind of always be there and studying. So it allowed me to kind of do my other things as well. And then because I came back to live at San Francisco Zen Center in my first year at Stanford, one of the abbots there, who I knew was one of my teachers, suggested that I start studying with him in preparation of receiving what's called Dharma transmission, which is to be get transmitted to be a full-fledged Zen teacher. And and so I started that training with him and met with him on a weekly basis for a few years in preparation for that process. And then at some point in the mid-90s, I finished that process and went through this transmission ceremony and became, you know, at least on paper, a Zen teacher. And so at some point, the Zen and Vipassana practices were parallel practices for me. And I never felt that they were kind of in opposition to each other. I found that if anything, they were complementary to each other, very supportive of each other. Both of them, I love them a lot. But what are the advantages? There's advantages and disadvantages to being in more than one tradition this way. Disadvantage, especially for someone who's a beginner, is you never go very deep. You kind of skim the surface of two. But one of the advantages is that they both have their strengths, and you get the strengths from both traditions. Also, when you're involved in two traditions like that, sometimes you can see the other tradition better. You have a better position to understand what's going on. And so I understand much better, I think, because the weaknesses of both traditions as well, the way they're kind of weak. And so there's both strengths and weaknesses in both traditions. And so what happened then is that the world of Vipassana teaching kept inviting me, asking me to teach in that world, and I was asked to teach a sitting group that we had in 1990 in Palo Alto, and that grew into what we have now. And then I started being asked to teach retreats, Vipassana retreats, and that's where the invitation, where the need for me, in a sense, was, where I was asked to come, and that kind of started filling my time. The Zen world, San Francisco Zen Center, they have a lot of priests and teachers there. And they don't need one more. So they didn't ask me to teach, even though I was a teacher. So it was kind of like my life kind of went where the invitations, where the need, where the vacuum was, in a sense. And so now my life is so filled with Vipassana. In the course of that, in the last 20 years, it's also brought me into contact with the early teachings of the Buddha. And so with that deepening study of Buddhism, I've had increasing questions about Zen Buddhism, some questions about the teachings of it, even though it's very meaningful for me still, and very inspired by the teachings of the Buddha. And the more I study it, the more inspired I am about it, but not completely. There's some questions there as well. But I find it there's something about the practicality of it, the non-metaphysical quality of it, the almost rational aspects of it, where it's almost a form of very deep, radical therapy, more than some kind of religious belief or faith, is very meaningful for me. Zen Buddhism, as I understand it, and some of my Zen teacher friends will powerfully debate this with me, but my feeling is that, my understanding is that Zen is a faith-based religion, where there's a fundamental faith that's very important for it that you have to kind of understand in order to make it work. Now, my teacher friends disagree with me, but we can have that debate. And that Theravada Buddhism, Vipassana Buddhism, whereas confidence, the faith that's kind of like confidence, is very important. Faith is not is not the same. It's almost like in Zen, there's almost like a metaphysical belief or faith you have. And then one way it's worded in Zen is that, in Soto Zen, in particular schools of Zen, is that you're already a Buddha. You already have Buddha nature, and it's a matter of expressing that or being that. Nothing needs to be attained, nothing needs to go anywhere. It's all perfect, just the way it is. You just have to kind of awaken to that, be present for that. And from my point of view, that's a faith statement. In Theravada Buddhism, they don't make statements like that. What they say is, if you happen to suffer, if that's something you've noticed in yourself, then here's a path to help free you from that suffering. So in that sense, it's kind of like therapy. But to call it therapy is to almost, is to belittle it. It's to belittle how amazingly deep spiritual transformation entails. But that's why I say that Zen has more to do with faith, and Vipassana has more to do with something else. However, that faith of Zen is a faith that I have. So I feel very strongly connected to it as well. In my own way, I'd word it maybe a little differently than how it's worded sometimes in Zen. So for me, I feel strongly connected to both. I have questions about both. I haven't been involved in Zen so much in the last 15 years or so, 12 years. So, I haven't had a chance to explore it and deepen it and question it and the same way that I have for the Vipassana and Theravada Buddhism. And maybe someday I'll have that chance. But in the meantime, I'm very, very happy and content in this tradition. And I'm very content offering this tradition to everyone, because I think it'll take people as far as you need to go, if you want to go someplace or not go someplace, take you there too. And there's kind of a deepening process for the whole community, me and the whole community, kind of being involved in this one tradition here and exploring it. And I think it's really a marvelous thing, both to deepen in one particular tradition, but it's also, I think, a marvelous thing to deepen enough so you can begin asking really good questions about the tradition and about yourself in the process. So not just accept it all as it is, but to actually begin questioning, engaging in it, and kind of debating with the tradition itself, rather than taking it, this is the truth. And so this is the tradition that I'm mostly involved in that process with. And so when I teach in Vipassana, it might not be obvious when I give Dharma talks, but the back behind what I'm trying to do in the Dharma talks is also the whole questioning process that the tradition, as well as to offer it and offer the practice in a way that's hopefully useful for a wide range of people. So, you know, it's certainly an adequate presentation. There's a lot more to be said about these two traditions. It's inevitable that I've offended someone in these traditions by saying it this way. People disagree. But that's my best shot here today. And maybe some other time, if you want to ask questions about that, we can have more discussion. So, thank you.